Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Professional Responsibility and Legal Education and Litigation Practice Groups, was recorded on Monday, September 22, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our telephone topic is the new book entitled Law of the Jungle, the $19 billion legal battle over oil in the rainforest and the lawyer who'd stop at nothing to win. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We welcome today to today's call the author of Law of the Jungle and commentator Jack Park, who's going to give some responses to Mr. Barrett's opening remarks. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of about 8 to 10 minutes, and then maybe some back and forth, and as always, questions from the audience. So please feel free to ring in with your questions at the appropriate time later in the program. Paul M. Barrett is author, as I mentioned, of the book Law of the Jungle, the $19 billion legal battle over oil in the rainforest and the lawyer who'd stop at nothing to win. He's also assistant managing editor and senior writer at Bloomberg Businessweek. We're going to hear afterwards from longtime Federalist Society member and supporter, Mr. John J. Park, Jr., of counsel at Strickland Brockington Lewis, better known as Jack Park. But with that, Mr. Barrett, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Well, thanks so much, Dean. I really appreciate the opportunity to address your audience. I'll begin with two clashing court judgments. In February 2011, a New York plaintiff's attorney named Stephen Donziger won a $19 billion verdict against Chevron in a provincial court in the rainforest in Ecuador. This was the biggest single environmental judgment ever against a single defendant. It also was the one and only civil lawsuit that Stephen Donziger had ever filed in his career since graduating from Harvard Law School. Quite an extraordinary event, celebrated as a tremendous victory in environmentalist activist circles. Seemed like an extraordinary win. At least that's what it seemed like at the time. Almost exactly 3 years later, in March 2014 of this year, a federal judge in New York ruled that this extraordinary Ecuadorian judgment was in fact a complete sham based on fabricated evidence, coercion of witnesses and justice and judges, and bribery. My book, Law of the Jungle, seeks to make sense of these seemingly irreconcilable judgments, the collision between the determination of the Ecuadorian judiciary and the American federal judiciary. The bottom line is this is a story of a campaign to save the rainforest that went horribly awry. The story begins in the 1960s when Ecuador sought outside investment to take advantage of rich oil reserves in the rainforest region known as El Oriente. Texaco, which was later acquired by Chevron, answered Ecuador's call, signed a series of agreements with the Ecuadorian government, and began producing oil in the early 1970s, which it shipped up over the Andes via a pipeline that it built especially for this purpose, which at the time was one of the great engineering feats of all Latin America. The oil industry became the backbone of the Ecuadorian economy. Aggregate living standards improved, life expectancy improved, infant mortality decreased. Unfortunately, as Ecuador became wealthier overall, economic inequality worsened. This is not a simple, straightforward story. It's a story with a lot of complexity to it. In relative terms, Ecuador's poorest citizens grew poorer, and the poor people living near the oil operations in El Oriente suffered severe environmental side effects from the unregulated industrialization of the rainforest. I want to be plain about this. Texaco made a mess of the jungle. It dug hundreds of Olympic swimming pool-sized pits into which it poured toxic oil byproducts. These pits were earthen. They were unlined. Texaco considered lining them at what would have been at that time a relatively modest cost of several million dollars, and it decided not to just to save the money. Texaco also discharged billions of gallons of tainted production water into streams and rivers. This is the water that comes up with the oil from underground. In the early 1990s, Ecuador nationalized its oil industry and set Texaco packing. Texaco returned home to a plaintiff's lawyer welcome, a class action lawsuit filed in New York in 1993 seeking $1 billion in damages for ecological harm. Texaco fought this lawsuit not so much on the merits, but on procedural grounds, arguing under a concept that the listeners on this call in any way will recognize, forum non convenience, that Ecuador was the proper venue, if any, for this lawsuit. The oil company submitted affidavits from Ecuadorian jurists and law professors saying that the Ecuadorian judiciary is perfectly capable of handling this case. These procedural issues were litigated for 9 long years in the federal courts in New York, up and down to the Second Circuit. In 2001, just as Chevron was taking over Texaco, the U.S. courts dismissed the case, granted the oil company's request that the case be sent to Ecuador, in effect. And the lesson here was, be careful what you wish for. Chevron absorbed Texaco, assuming that the plaintiff's lawyers were exhausted, financially, psychologically, and otherwise. The oil company assumed that even if Texaco refiled a suit in Ecuador, it would go nowhere because the Ecuadorian courts had never seen a class action, had no jurisprudence to deal with mass litigation. Finally, the company assumed that Ecuador's right-leaning politics would favor corporate interests and the weak judiciary there would bend to Chevron's will. Chevron miscalculated on several counts. In fact, in the interim from the time this lawsuit began to the time to the 2000s, Ecuador's politics were swinging quite markedly from right to left. While historically Ecuador had no provision for mass litigation, while the case was pending in New York, the plaintiff's lawyers who were pursuing it were also traveling to Ecuador, consulting with Ecuadorian lawmakers, and advising them on the enactment in 1999 of a brand new statute, the Environmental Management Act, which provided for something akin to a class action for the first time. Finally, Chevron miscalculated by not perceiving that Stephen Donziger, the lawyer I mentioned at the outset, had basically taken control of the case. He had shouldered aside his older colleagues and made this case his entire life. Donziger was a former reporter who had covered the Nicaraguan Civil War in the 1980s. He was a former prisoner activist. He was a graduate of Harvard Law School, where he was a friend of Barack Obama. He was a wizard, it turned out, at marshaling celebrity backing and media attention. Among his core of celebrity endorsers were Sting, Trudy Styler, Bianca Jagger, Daryl Hannah, Mia Farrow, even Cher. He marshaled extremely sympathetic coverage in such publications as Vanity Fair, 60 Minutes, normally skeptical of corporate behavior, broadcast a very sympathetic piece to Donziger's cause. CNN did the same. And he basically procured a documentary film by a very eminent documentary filmmaker named Joe Berlinger, a film called Crude that debuted in 2009 to widespread critical acclaim, but would later come back to haunt Donziger in a way that we can discuss a little bit further in the call. Apart from his media impresario accomplishments, Donziger was something of a practitioner of what I think of as avant-garde legal tactics. Persuaded that the only way to take on a major oil company was to bend the rules, he did that and did it with tremendous verve. He cajoled and bullied Ecuadorian judges in private. He submitted scientific evidence to the Ecuadorian courts that he knew was faulty because his own paid experts had privately told him that it was faulty. He bribed and manipulated a supposedly neutral court-appointed expert whose work he had had his own American technical advisors ghostwrite. He choreographed bribes for all too willing and corrupt Ecuadorian judges. And worse than all of that, worse than all of the legal corruption, was the fact that during the course of this litigation in Ecuador, he was actively lobbying the Correa administration. That's the current president of Ecuador, Rafael Correa. He was lobbying the Ecuadorian government not to clean up the pollution sites, to leave the contamination in place, to prop up the lawsuit and provide the visual backdrop for his celebrity tours of these sites. In February 2011, these efforts paid off with that $19 billion verdict, or so it seemed, because the same month Chevron filed suit against Donziger back here in New York under the U.S. RICO law. In February, in 2013, in the fall, there was an extraordinary six-week trial before U.S. District Judge Lewis Kaplan on Chevron's charges that Donziger had perhaps begun working on something that was a lawsuit, but that this effort, the combination of legal activity, illicit activity in Ecuador, and all of the media pressure, had evolved into the equivalent of a corporate shakedown, an extortion scheme. And on March 4th, Judge Kaplan said that's exactly what had happened. In his ruling, 485 pages long, Judge Kaplan wrote, "The plaintiff's team wrote the Lago Agrio court's judgment themselves and promised $500,000 to the Ecuadorian judge to rule in their favor and sign their judgment." In other words, Judge Kaplan concluded that the judgment itself had been ghostwritten by the plaintiffs. "This case," the judge added, "includes things that normally come only out of Hollywood." I would have to agree with him, and I'd add that the story will make for a very dark movie. So that's my first cut at it, and Jack, I'd be very eager to hear your thoughts.
Thank you, Paul, and thanks to the Federalist Society for this opportunity. Paul's book is an engaging, it's a fascinating, well-written story that raises questions about the rule of law, the role of the courts, and the role of lawyers. And as he writes, hubris was the downfall of Stephen Donziger. As part of Donziger's orchestration of the case, Paul has talked about it. He allowed a filmmaker to film his interactions with the. I'm sorry, another call has come in, but let me ignore it. I'm sorry. He allowed a filmmaker to film his interactions with the Ecuadorian judiciary, his team, including experts and other events, and the outtakes from that film were the source of his downfall. You know, if you think about the rule of law, some of the elements include an independent and transparent judiciary, and as Paul has set out, in this case, the Ecuadorian judiciary failed the test. It allowed itself to be bribed and bullied by Donziger and his allies. It tolerated ex-party contacts from Donziger's surrogates and just failed in tests of independence and transparency. You know, and some of this is ironic, as Paul notes the irony. It was Chevron that I think correctly insisted that a case involving oil pollution in the Ecuadorian jungle belonged in Ecuador, not federal court in New York, but it was that federal court in New York that ultimately saved Chevron's bacon. In my judgment, though, the irony runs both ways, though, because Donziger told the federal court not to throw him into the Ecuadorian briar patch because of the limitations of that forum, and it's something that he made use of. With respect to Donziger, the outtakes show exactly how he approached the courts and things in Ecuador. And once there, he said things like, "We have concluded that we need to do more politically to control the court, to pressure the court. We believe they make decisions based on who they fear the most, not based on what the laws should dictate." Another time he said, "Hold on a second. You know this is Ecuador, okay? You can say whatever you want, and at the end of the day, there's 1,000 people around the courthouse. You're going to get what you want. Sorry, but it's true." And then in another crude outtake, Donziger, as Paul writes, preached a coarse version of critical legal studies. "I once worked for a lawyer who said something that I have never forgotten. Facts do not exist. Facts are created. Ever since that day, I realized how the law works." And as Paul explains, that witticism might elicit nods in a Harvard seminar on the elusive nature of knowledge. From the mouth of a practicing lawyer, it suggested a willingness to manipulate evidence, and Paul describes that willingness to manipulate evidence and the courts. And it's demonstrated in a variety of ways. His initial expert posed a $6 billion damages figure that was very tentative, but Donziger avidly used it even after its author, who characterized it as a scientific wild guess, or SWAG, disavowed it as wildly inaccurate and said it should not be used. He created reports that another
expert, an industrial hygienist, Kalmbacher, purportedly prepared. His team then made improper and unjustified payments to a nominally independent court expert who was, in fact, selected by Donziger and his team after they assessed that expert's pliability, concluding that he would, quote, totally play ball with them, and whose report they and their consultants ghostwrote. That nominally independent expert was appointed after Donziger's team threatened the then judge with a misconduct complaint. Finally, not content with wiring the substantive process, they bribed the judge who rendered the judgment in their favor and wrote the decision for him. And all of that produced an unenforceable $18 billion judgment against Chevron, where hubris brought down Donziger, old-fashioned greed cost others. A hedge fund bought a piece of the case and lost it. Pat and Boggs also bought in as part of a plan to enforce the judgment by attaching Chevron assets throughout the world. And as most of us know, Pat and Boggs has been absorbed into Squire Sanders. And I asked the question, you know, what do lawsuits do? Do they decide disputes or can they resolve problems? And my view is that they decide disputes. They're not real good at solving problems. But if the problem was oil pollution in the Amazonian jungle, that was Chevron's responsibility. The lawsuit didn't clean it up or help any of the people allegedly sickened by the oil pollution. Why not? Because Donziger's new business model crashed and burned. That new business model married hedge fund financing and leftist politics and left those who were arguably injured by Chevron high and dry. But in a larger sense, I think that courts that are independent as a general matter, not institutionally suited to solving problems. They don't have the expertise to devise solutions. They lack the resources needed to monitor ongoing efforts to carry out a solution that's devised by one or both of the parties. And all that takes time, and the courts need to turn their attention to the next case, not stay on the resolution of a long-term problem. And I think in the end, you know, Donziger failed by turning his case into a cause. As Paul notes, he got 60 Minutes coverage in New York Times, Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, Bloomberg, the documentary, Hollywood, and other support. And in so doing, I think Donziger lost sight of his role, which should have been to vindicate the interests of his clients within the confines of the law. He ignored counterindications, and when you get counterindications, it's a suggestion as to lawyers, look at your whole cards and see if you really have the case you thought you did when you started. But Donziger embraced, as Paul says, critical legal studies at Harvard, which is a cynical view of the law as power. And he thought that by demonstrating greater power in Ecuador, he would get what he wanted. And in the end, I think lawsuits are lawsuits. They have to proceed as lawsuits and not as causes. And with that, I'll give it back to Dean.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I do want to turn to the audience for questions. So let's let them begin to queue up here. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We're talking today, of course, with the author of Law of the Jungle. I'm not going to repeat the subtitle, but it's very descriptive, both the title and the subtitle. And in the notice you got for today's call, there is a link to the Amazon.com page for The Law of the Jungle. It's available for pre-order and comes out tomorrow. Is that correct, Mr. Barrett?
That's exactly right. Amazon promises they'll deliver it to you tomorrow.
So I suppose if you order it today, you can get it just as soon as you'd like, although I suppose the electronic version is not available until tomorrow. In any event, before we turn to the audience for questions, let me just give a quick rundown of upcoming Teleform conference calls. Our next scheduled conference call is Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. The Teleform topic then is Getting It Right on Crime. During that call, we'll be discussing incarceration policy around the country. That's Wednesday at 3. Then on Thursday at 2, we'll be discussing the federal monitoring of local and police and state police powers. And on Friday at the early hour of 11 a.m. Eastern Time, we'll get an update on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Today our topic, of course, is the law of the jungle. Let's go to our first caller.
Yes, thank you. Was the fraud regarding just the question of damages, or did it pervade into the liability scheme, a liability question? And if it did not pertain to liability, does the government of Ecuador or the plaintiffs still have an opportunity to go back to court to get some justice in the case?
Yeah, shall I go ahead and give that a shot?
Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, please do.
All right. The fraud, sad to say, was pervasive and included questions about the basic evidence as to whether there was a connection between the oil pollution and the health harms that were claimed by the thousands of people who live, sadly, all too close to the oil operations in the rainforest in Ecuador. There also were, you know, very serious questions about who actually had left behind the oil contamination. When this lawsuit began in 1993, it was unquestionable that whatever oil pollution existed on the ground there had been the legacy of Texaco, because it had run these oil fields for some 20 plus years. But as the lawsuit evolved, and by the time it was refiled in Ecuador in 2003, PetroEcuador, the national oil company, had actually been running the oil fields for a period of years. And if anything, PetroEcuador had proved itself to be a worse polluter than Texaco. So the question of this oil pit or that spill or that ruined stream and who was responsible for that had become very murky. And sad to say, Donziger marshaled evidence in such a way that there were questions as to whether he was presenting legitimate evidence, not just about the extent of the damages, but also about the underlying liability and causation.
Yeah, I guess to phrase it a little bit differently, you know, if you're in a situation like that where you have multiple causes, you'd want to allocate it by causal factor. Unless, you know, there are some theories here in the United States about enterprise liability where you've seen lead-based paint judgments. But then separate and apart from that, you'd want to have, to the extent health claims were made, you'd want to have a causal link between the pollution and the health claims. And one other complicating factor that Paul describes in the book is that Texaco entered into a deal with Ecuador to remediate the problems it caused. Now, whether that remediation was effective is, you know, open to question. But if that was remediated, then why should Chevron answer for Texaco's remediation? Texaco remediated.
That's exactly right, Jack. I mean, the actual agreement when Texaco left the country. And this agreement, by the way, was not in place in 1993 when the lawsuit was first filed. So again, in 1993, there may well have been very legitimate claims. But by the time you got into later in the 90s, Texaco had signed an agreement with the government of Ecuador under which Texaco had cleaned up one-third of the pollution sites. That one-third measure reflected Texaco's ownership interest in the consortium. The government of Ecuador had owned two-thirds of the consortium for most of the duration of that joint effort. And the government of Ecuador, it's important to note, had both signed that agreement and signed a release saying that Texaco was free and clear from liability. So the oil company had, in contractual terms, in strict legal terms, by 1998, a very serious defense. Now, you can make other arguments, as Jack said, about the effectiveness of the remediation, whether maybe Chevron, once it acquired the company, had some kind of larger moral or maybe just practical obligation to resolve this whole situation. But it was very complex, and the oil company certainly had a contractual basis for saying, whatever pollution we caused, we've taken care of our obligations, and what remains is the obligation of the Ecuadorians.
Once again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions pending, and then our lines will be open. Let's go to our next caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. This case may illustrate one of the points that people often don't understand about what a court can and cannot do. What a court really is. It is not some form of magic. When two or more parties have a dispute and the general public doesn't know who to side with, the court can be useful in bringing out the issues and developing a decision on who is at fault or most at fault. But it still relies on the surrounding community enforce any judgment. Judgments are not personally enforced by judges. They are enforced by essentially custom and of those surrounding the courts. And if the custom is lacking, if there's not confidence in the courts, or if there's not an apparatus in place whereby people will more or less agree, have a consensus to go along with whatever the court decides, then it all breaks down. And in a case like this involving two different countries, the courts of one and the government of another, I don't think it's probably possible to have that kind of consensus that would make the execution of any judgment possible. So for problems of that kind, the solution is diplomacy or commerce, or negotiation of some kind, but it's not to be found in the courts, and we need to understand the limitations of civil litigation.
Mr. Barrett, you have a response or reaction?
I think there's a great deal of wisdom in what that gentleman is saying, which is not to say that certain types of lawsuits, once initiated, as he noted, can't be very good instruments for bringing certain facts to the surface, for putting potential values on claims people have. But there's a reason why mass litigation generally, civil lawsuits of all sorts, generally settle out of court, and that's because in the end you need compromise. You need to stop the sort of neurotic cycle of litigation and accusations and get to some practical solution. And that's one thing that really has been lacking in this situation. I think it's been lacking for several reasons. But the main one is that through his misconduct, as determined by the federal court in New York, and through his any means to the end that he sought, that philosophy, Donziger was able to fight his way to a verdict of sorts, a judgment of sorts, but not one that was going to be enforceable in any sort of normal, conventional, structured legal system. He has a judgment in Ecuador, but Chevron has no assets in Ecuador. So as the gentleman said, there's no way to really enforce it in a meaningful way. He's taken it to other countries, Canada, Argentina, Brazil, and he's seeking to enforce it there. But we can count on Chevron to show up in those countries with their U.S. court judgment and say to the judiciaries of those countries, this man does not have a real judgment. He's got a sham, a fake. And I think it's unlikely that anything constructive is going to come out of this long, sad story unless there is some type of politically oriented compromise over it.
All right, two questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Yes, Yeah, I have a question about the ongoing litigation in the Second Circuit. I think, Mr. Barrett, you've done an excellent job of outlining all of the fraud that Mr. Donziger engaged in. But as I understand it, the appellants in that case include not only Mr. Donziger himself, but many of the individual plaintiffs from the Ecuadorian case who have been brought in involuntarily into the New York case. And one of the arguments being made by the other side is, okay, assuming that there was fraud at the trial court in Ecuador, that there was an appellate decision issued by a theoretically impartial court in Ecuador issuing a de novo judgment, and they came to the same conclusion as the trial court did. And regardless of all of the evidence of fraud, and obviously there's a huge amount of it, isn't it something that the United States opened themselves up to claims that that they are acting somewhat imperialistically in refusing to give any sort of deference to a decision from an appellate court in Ecuador that theoretically anyway issued a de novo judgment?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And you have summarized the argument that has been made on behalf of Donziger's erstwhile clients very accurately. Let me add a few elements to it and then respond to your question. In a fascinating fashion, there's a new lawyer in the case who has parachuted in for purposes of the Second Circuit appeal. That's Bert Newborn, a long-time human rights lawyer. He now represents, pro bono, by the way, he now represents the people who were Donziger's clients separately from Donziger. And he is appealing on their behalf, not in cooperation with Donziger, but quite separately, because obviously, as your question implies, the interests of Donziger and his clients are no longer exactly the same. His clients can argue, and Bert Newborn has argued, that even if Donziger committed fraud, the clients, who Newborn describes as unsophisticated residents of the rainforest, should not be punished. And his legal reasoning is exactly as you described, because, as he put it, in the Ecuadorian legal system, unlike the American system, the appellate courts, and there were two appellate decisions here which affirmed the problematic trial judgment against Chevron, the appellate courts in Ecuador do undertake what they call de novo review. They start from scratch, supposedly. And Professor Newborn has argued that the U.S. court system should not be looking at the trial judgment. They should be looking at the intermediate appellate court judgment and the Ecuadorian Supreme Court judgment. Those higher courts in Ecuador basically said, we don't care if there was fraud. We've looked at the court record, and we think there's enough evidence of Chevron's liability and enough evidence of the damages to uphold the verdict. Now, I think in essence, Chevron's response to that, and we're going to see Chevron's response, by the way, on October 1st, which is its deadline for filing its responsive papers in the Second Circuit. But I'll predict that if you boil down Chevron's answer, it's going to be this. It may be that you can have de novo review of a judgment that is flawed, but you can't have de novo review of a judgment that doesn't exist. You can't. If some fraud is so great and so thorough that you don't have anything tangible. There's no verdict there to look at. It's as if you're trying to divide zero, and that when you have a completely sham and corrupt trial judgment, a court cannot legitimately conduct a de novo review. And I think Chevron's going to say to the Second Circuit, that's our main argument. I think as a secondary argument, Chevron is going to say, even if there is something enforceable here in third countries, whether it's the United States or Brazil or Argentina or wherever, even if there's something enforceable, something that could flow to these plaintiffs, this lawyer, who is a New York registered lawyer, licensed in this city, resident in this city, a citizen of the United States, this lawyer cannot be allowed to profit from his misconduct. And I think Chevron will make that argument very strongly. And I think, frankly, it's unlikely that the Second Circuit will disturb Judge Kaplan's factual findings about the fraud, even if, as you suggest, the Second Circuit may give some effect on grounds of comity, international respect, and so forth, to some element of the verdict. And I think that's the compromise that Professor Newborn, representing the actual alleged victims, is seeking before the Second Circuit. I think he's perfectly prepared to see Donziger punished, in effect, as long as some element of the original finding as to the actual Ecuadorian residence is preserved.
Jack Park, you have anything on this point?
Well, I think, you know, it was, some of our laws apply extraterritorially, but this was a RICO case. The question, you know, that's posed is RICO extraterritorial? As to enforcement, I think John Rowland is right. Say that the plaintiffs seek to enforce the Ecuadorian judgment in Brazil, and Chevron opposes it, and it's basically a question of international comity, whether Brazil will decide to honor that judgment, which Chevron says is fundamentally flawed.
All right, we've got three questions pending, so let's go to our next caller.
Yes, the question of the tainting of the evidence, was there an effort to separate the good from the bad, or was it so commingled that a fact finder couldn't possibly find anything but a tainted pool?
Well, certainly the plaintiffs would argue, and the trial judge essentially argued, that there may have been some evidence of fraud. The trial judge, this is in Ecuador, in his 188-page single-space judgment, basically acknowledged that Donziger had committed certain types of misconduct, that there were serious questions raised about the legitimacy, for example, of this neutral damages experts report. The trial judge actually purported to set that evidence aside and said there's still plenty of evidence left, much along the lines of what you've just suggested. But here's the question. If there is evidence that's clear and convincing, as Judge Kaplan found in New York, that multiple judges involved in this case along the way took bribes and ghostwrote each other's rulings, if there is evidence that multiple scientific experts who were paid to provide advice to Donziger along the way have in the intervening years disavowed that advice and said their advice and their conclusions and the expert evidence that they provided was fraudulent, in that light, is the verdict that's based on that evidence something that's supportable? Moreover, Judge Kaplan concluded, and he concluded this not by a criminal standard, but also not by a preponderance of the evidence standard. He concluded, based on clear and convincing evidence, that the final judgment itself was secretly ghostwritten by the plaintiffs in exchange for an offer of $500,000. That's Judge Kaplan's finding. That's not my finding. If that's the case, it's not clear to me, you know, what there is to salvage. So that would be my answer to your question.
In Judge Kaplan's ruling, this is Jack, he, on page 192 of the copy I've got, he points to overwhelming and unrefuted evidence that showed that portions of eight of the plaintiff team's internal work product documents appear verbatim or in substance in the judgment. Those documents were never filed with the Ecuadorian trial court or made part of the official case record. And he says, defendants, that's Donziger and the others in the New York proceeding, utterly failed to explain how or why their internal work product, their fingerprints, show up in the judgment. And the most logical conclusion is that members of the plaintiff team wrote at least material portions of the judgment and probably substantially all of it, and that they copied from their own internal files in doing so.
Is the corruption just financial, or is there some political pressure? I take it the government of Ecuador would stand to gain by voting for Chevron.
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, there's been a question all along about why this entire conflict has been set up as a duel between the alleged individual victims and Texaco, now Chevron alone, and why the government of Ecuador, which as a contractual matter in the original arrangement had an obligation to clean up two-thirds of these sites and never has done so. So that question has been pending there all along, and clearly right now what's going on in Ecuador, and I think this is true no matter what you think about the resolution of the actual in-court litigation, clearly the current administration in Ecuador of Rafael Correa is using Chevron in a symbolic way as a distraction from local political conflicts. I mean, Correa makes a speech practically every weekend shaking his fist at Chevron as a symbol of Yankee imperialism, and claims that it is entirely Chevron's responsibility to remedy the problems in the rainforest, when there also really is no dispute that for the last 20 years, it's Petroecuador that's been polluting in that area, and that at a minimum, the government of Ecuador bears some responsibility here. So there is absolutely no doubt that Ecuador as a country has a huge interest in trying to shift all the blame to Chevron.
Was Patton Boggs brought in to inflame that political issue domestically?
No, I think that would be a misleading way of describing Patton Boggs' role. I think Patton Boggs was brought in as enforcement muscle. Patton Boggs is a very well-connected, politically well-connected law firm with former diplomats in its partnership and among its lobbying corps, contacts all around the world, and actually had a distinct practice group that specialized in third country enforcement. And Patton Boggs was brought in because it had that legal muscle. In fact, Patton Boggs showed up here, I think it's important to underscore, at the behest of one of the hedge funds that came into the case in 2010. A hedge fund called Burford Capital said it would chip in some $4 million up front with $11 million to follow, but only if Patton Boggs came in to enforce the judgment that they were anticipating Donzer would be able to win sometime in the near future. So Patton Boggs came in with this outside financing coming from the hedge fund, and Patton Boggs was arranged to receive a significant chunk of the legal fees that would be generated by the successful enforcement. I don't think Patton Boggs ever thought there would actually be an enforcement that Chevron would pay on. I think Patton Boggs thought that once it was in the case, Chevron would get scared and finally Chevron would settle. What Patton Boggs and Donziger and Burford Capital failed to take into their calculus, I think, is that by that time, Chevron had really taken an unusual stance. I think Chevron's whole corporate psychology had shifted such that it felt in an indignant fashion that a wrong had been committed, and it was going to spend whatever it took to continue to fight.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We have two questions pending, then our lines are open. Let's take another question.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the very interesting presentation. A question to the author, Mr. Barrett. In doing your research for your book, did you come to any conclusions about the pervasiveness of bribery and corruption in Latin American courts? And follow on to that is, to what extent did you conclude that American corporations or individuals who are parties to those Latin American court proceedings participate in the bribery and corruption?
Yeah, very good questions. I would limit my comments only to Ecuador. I am not an expert on Latin American judiciaries generally, and have not studied those judiciaries on a continent-wide basis. What I observed based on now going on 4 years of reporting on this case is that at the trial level anyway, in Ecuador, a significant number of judges there take on the judicial robes, figuratively speaking, they don't actually wear robes there, in order to sell the position, in order to sell their services as corrupt pseudo judicial officials. Four out of the six judges who sat on this case from 2003 to 2011 at the trial level, four out of the six were eventually banished from the court for one type of misconduct or another. Some of it related to this case, some of it unrelated to this case, and involving things like letting drug convicts go for no obvious reason. The corruption here was pervasive, and it is not the case that a corrupt American plaintiff's lawyer approached a pure and well-intentioned judiciary. What he apparently did was take advantage of a judiciary that was all too ready to sell its services to the highest bidder. As to whether, I think companies dealing in an environment like that ought to be very, very wary. That would be an understatement. I think at the trial level in Ecuador anyway, justice is very much up for sale.
Is there any indication, this is Dean, is any indication that companies are feeling emboldened by the results in the Chevron case, or is it too soon to tell? Or
may I answer that?
Yes, please.
Okay. I think it's a little bit too soon to tell whether there'll be like a mass move toward the extreme step that Chevron took of invoking the RICO statute and naming the plaintiff's lawyer as a defendant in a RICO enterprise. However, the Chevron case is not entirely isolated. The Gibson Dunn law firm, which is the law firm that Chevron brought in midstream in 2009 to sort of go on the offense instead of continuing to play defense, Gibson Dunn was brought in because Gibson Dunn had considerable success on behalf of another company in a similar fashion. Gibson Dunn had represented Dole Foods in litigation in Nicaragua pertaining to pesticides used in banana cultivation. And Gibson Dunn was able to prove that claims against Dole, individual alleged victims, were frauds. Individuals who were said to have worked for Dole were never employees of that company. Individuals were said to have been rendered sterile by their exposure to the pesticides. In fact, had multiple children and that kind of thing. And so it was really that success with Dole that won Gibson Dunn the assignment with Chevron. Since all of this has unfolded, we've already seen some other instances where large corporations are, in fact, beginning to invoke RICO in similar situations. This has come up, for example, in the context of the latter stages asbestos litigation. CSX, the transportation company, has sued plaintiff's lawyers successfully, accusing them of fraud in bringing asbestos-related claims against CSX. A company called Garlock is currently engaged in a fascinating case in which it is using the RICO law to fight back against what it says are fraudulent and exaggerated claims of asbestos-related liability. And that's a case very much worth looking into because, as I say, it's live right now. There have been some preliminary rulings by a bankruptcy judge that there's been rampant fraud. So I don't know how broad this trend will spread, but I think certainly Chevron is a test case, and it should be troubling to everybody. I mean, I don't think any lawyer really wants to see the merits of injury claims litigated through the prism of the RICO law. Upstanding lawyers want to see the merits of the claims sorted out on their own terms. The problem is if you have corrupt lawyers bringing the claims, and you don't have law enforcement stepping in or bar authorities stepping in, I think companies will sort of take matters into their own hands and basically step into the shoes of law enforcement the way Chevron here is. I mean, you can see Chevron in this case is sort of playing like the private FBI, doing business with all kinds of shady characters in Ecuador in order to surface evidence that it was done wrong and surface evidence that there was a big conspiracy against the company.
Once again, we're speaking with the author of Law of the Jungle. If you have a question for him or Mr. Jack Park, please push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending, then our lines are wide open. So let's go to our next caller.
Hi, I'm interested in Mr. Donziger and what's going on with him. First of all, how in the world did he manage to, spend so much of his life doing this without any apparent? I mean, where was he getting money from if he was spending his life pursuing this lawsuit? And second of all, no one seems to be denying that he committed fraud, and so I'm wondering what the status is of his law license. Is he being pursued by the disciplinary committees in New York, or has he been disbarred?
Those are very valid questions. the answer to your first one is Donziger, first of all, is married. His wife is a successful professional, they are able to live a middle-class life, even with the expensive cost of living on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, in part because of her income. Second, while he has pursued this lawsuit for many, many years, there's been a fair amount of outside financing for the lawsuit. In its earlier stages, it was financed to the tune of some $7 million by the Cohn, Swift & Graff plaintiff law firm out of Philadelphia. And Donziger, for a number of years, basically just was paid a stipend. I mean, he was paid a salary to pursue the case. When Cohn, Swift & Graff had a falling out with him because they eventually concluded that he was being dishonest with them in how he was running the case, and the lead lawyer there, Joe Cohn, eventually formally accused Donziger of deceiving him. When Cohn, Swift & Graff bowed out, Donziger then turned to the hedge fund option and began raising money basically from investors who now invested in the case not in the form of the traditional way that plaintiffs' firms do in terms of putting money into a case in exchange for a contingency fee. These new speculators were putting money into the case in exchange for a share of the recovery. In other words, for a share of the money off the top, not just a share of legal fees. So he got money from in the order of millions of dollars from this Burford fund. He also was able to get investments that, at so far as I can tell, based on legal filings, have totaled some $23 million from a law school classmate of his, who is an online poker magnate based in Gibraltar. I kid you not. I know that sounds like a Hollywood touch, but it's quite specific. This gentleman's name is Russell DeLeon, and he invested both in that documentary film, which became so problematic because Chevron was able to get its hands through the discovery process, get its hands on the field tapes from that film, which proved to be incriminating. But DeLeon has also invested directly in the case, and so a lot of the financing came from him. And he did this in exchange for an interest in the ultimate recovery. So we don't fully know how many people have invested in this case, and we don't fully know, you know, who owns at this point what interests in it. But that's a big part of the answer as to how Donziger was able to keep this afloat. As to your final question about his bar status, I think it's a valid question. As of today, he is a member of the bar of the state of New York in good standing. Bar disciplinary authorities, of course, operate confidentially, so I don't know whether there's a file open on him. If I had to guess, I would assume that the bar authorities are certainly watching this case closely and may be waiting for the Second Circuit to rule on the merits of Judge Kaplan's March 2014 RICO findings before any determination is made as to whether to proceed against Donziger. But that, on my part, I want to stress, is speculation. I don't have any inside knowledge on that. But I would assume if Judge Kaplan's factual findings were affirmed, regardless of the legal niceties, international comedy, whether you can get a certain kind of injunction or not under the civil provisions of RICO if you're a private party, apart from all that, if his factual findings as to Donziger's conduct are affirmed, it would be very hard for me to imagine, A, that Judge Kaplan himself would not send a communication to the bar authorities to formally note what had transpired before him in his trial court. And B, it would be hard for me to imagine that the bar authorities in the state of New York would not take that very seriously.
Thanks.
All right. We're approaching the five-minute mark here. We've got two questions pending. Let's take another caller.
Yes, thank you. Sorry to come back. This is my last question. This is really a fascinating story. Hollywood won't touch it, though, because the bad guys win.
Let me interrupt you right there. Can I give you some good news? Hollywood has not only touched it, Hollywood has bought an option on my book.
Oh, great. Congratulations.
Yeah, there you go. So have some faith in Hollywood.
Let's hope John Travolta doesn't play the lead.
I'll express no opinion on that judgment.
He played in The Civil Action. That was a movie about 20 years ago about an environmental suit in this country that became a hit movie. The Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, I assume, applies to individuals as well as corporations. Is there any grand jury impaneled in the Southern District of New York to look at
very,
Donziger?
Very interesting question. Judge Kaplan, in his ruling, found that as a matter of the civil provisions of RICO, that Donziger had violated the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Now, that's not a criminal finding. It's very important to emphasize that. That was just an element of the many findings of civil liability that Judge Kaplan made. And is there a grand jury pending? I don't know. Grand juries, when they operate properly, or operate secretly. My very respected rival and colleague, Roger Parloff of Fortune magazine, who's another one of the journalists who has followed this case for many years and has done a terrific job covering it for his publication and his website. Roger wrote a piece very recently, the headline of which was, "Where's Preet?" Question mark. And the point of that piece was, where is the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York in connection with this case? Why hasn't there been a criminal investigation open? I highly commend Roger's piece to you. It's available online. Where's Preet? That's as in Preet Bharara, the U.S. Attorney here in New York. And I think it's an interesting and valid question.
All right. We've got time for a final question, so let's go to our next caller.
David Emerson, Society member in Berkeley. It's an interesting story. I'm interested in your perspective about whether or not this is just a statistical outlier and it's just merely interesting, or whether there's any kind of bigger, longer-term lessons that will be learned or changes in behavior that we can expect to see. And sort of, you know, to give a little more color on what I'm trying to get at, is that there's a certain amount of fraud which is reasonable and expected, not necessarily good. But over-allocation of resources in preventing fraud is not a good thing either. And what's unique about this case is the huge judgment and also a large defendant that decided to fight against it. And one can imagine if there was a much smaller amount at risk, let's say $100 million, that Exxon would have caved, or if it had been a smaller judgment-proof defendant, they would have not shown up. It's just one of these cases which is just an outlier. And But do you think that there is anything here longer term of benefit that's just an interesting story?
Yes, I think it's a very valid question. I think at one level, this clearly is an extraordinary story, an outlier story, to use your term. The degree of fraud alleged here, in my view, and more importantly, in Judge Kaplan's view, the degree of fraud that's been proven is extraordinary, just in terms of its volume and its audacity and the discrepancy between the claims made on behalf of justice and the vindication of the oppressed versus the actual conduct, which shows so much undermining of the rule of law. I would love to isolate it and say that it's a one-of-a-kind case and that Donziger is a one-of-a-kind rogue lawyer, but I think that would be overly optimistic. In the conclusion of my book, I point out that this case may just be a very extreme example of a tendency toward the corruption of mass litigation in general. I think that mass litigation, both in the United States and around the world, has in many ways gone off the rails. And one way you can see that is by looking at the extraordinary and saddening record of some of the best-known practitioners of mass litigation. It is very striking to me that the giants of the asbestos bar, the securities class action bar, and now Donziger have all ended up in trouble. You go back to the men who helped define mass litigation in its multi-billion dollar iterations in the 80s and 90s. You look at Mel Weiss, the securities strike suit guru, convicted criminally of misconduct and served prison time. Dickie Scruggs, the master of asbestos litigation, and after that, the tobacco litigation, convicted criminally of corruption and served prison time. You look at Bill LaRocque, the conqueror of Enron and scourge of corporate boardrooms around the country, convicted criminally of kickback schemes and served some prison time. Stan Chesley, the master of disaster from Cincinnati, was recently disbarred because of corruption charges. This is an extraordinary parade of some of the giants in this field ending up in, you know, not just mild trouble, not just allegations of sort of garden variety fraud, but, you know, like serious stuff that, that got the attention of prosecutors and bar authorities. And I think, sadly, Stephen Donziger has stepped into those shoes. I am not saying that he's been proven guilty of criminal conduct. He has not. He's been found liable under the civil provisions of the RICO law. But I think he's done tremendous damage to the very cause that he purported to represent. I think he has robbed of credibility the notion that ambitious transnational lawsuits are the way to vindicate human rights. I think he has contributed to the cynicism surrounding all of this. And I think this case, along with others like it, provided the background noise that has helped push the United States Supreme Court in recent years to sharply limit the ability of American lawyers to bring cases like this under the tort statute. And so there actually, I think, already is in the court system in this country something of a that's the alien tort statute I was referring to earlier, sorry. There already is something of a backlash in the judiciary because of declining faith in the propriety and the practicality of these mass lawsuits. The Supreme Court is reining in class actions. International human rights-related lawsuits are being reined in. And I think part of the reason for that, not the entire reason, but part of it, is that some of the practitioners themselves have not proven up to the task ethically, and they've undercut their own cause.
Sounds like it might be a follow-up book.
Well, at least it's the conclusion to this book. You just got a quick summary to my big sermon at the end of the book.
Very good. Well, my thanks to both author Paul Barrett and Jack Park for joining us today. I thank the audience as well for joining us and for your many and thoughtful questions. Our next scheduled Teleform conference call is Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, when we will be discussing incarceration policy around the country. But until that next Teleform conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thanks, Dean. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dean. And thanks to everybody.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.